couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films, Queen Pins, Kate, Language Lessons, The Lost Leonardo, Small Engine Repair, and Malignant. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Vertigo. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
In terms of October, which is shaping up to be a very interesting month, and we talked about this last week, you've got Venom dropping into the first weekend, which I don't know if that's a smart move. I think part of the reason they wanted to do that was so they could get the IMAX screens, which are going to be gobbled up by Dune the next week. But part of the problem with Venom is they've moved that around the calendar so many times just in the last 2 months. I think that there's less of an awareness of when that even comes out. So then you've got, of course, No Time to Die. And then you've got Halloween Kills. Well, the news came out this week that Universal is going to be putting Halloween Kills day and date on Peacock on October 15th, which is kind of a surprising move because we haven't seen that big of a push into streaming recently. And at least the word on the street is it's not necessarily that they're worried about the pandemic and the Delta variant and lower audience numbers. It's them wanting to beef up the subscription base to Peacock. And the movies that have been going recently, surprisingly, to those streaming services, stuff like The Boss Baby Part 2 and on Paramount Plus at Paw Patrol, they've been kids' movies. And I think part of the reason they also wanted to do this is they wanted to maximize the amount of watching time that happens with this Halloween movie before Halloween. Because you basically get 2 weeks and then the season's over. And while people are still going to be watching horror movies in November, they don't stop. But the push to watch it at home is going to be big. And I think that they're willing to forego the loss of on-demand to try and maximize the number of people watching that in October. So that's a big deal. And that also kind of dovetails into talking about the box office from last weekend. Shang-Chi did great last weekend. It did way better than I expected. And congratulations to everybody involved. It's one of these times where I'm kind of glad that I was wrong because I was a little worried. I thought it was going to go soft. The biggest reasons is it had a lot going against it. I mean, it had no big stars. It was an unknown character. There was a Labor Day curse. There was the whole COVID thing with the Delta variant. But it made $75 million in its 3-day and $95 million in its 4-day weekend. That does not beat the numbers that Black Widow did, even though they're not exactly the same because there was a day-and-date release and it was just a 3-day weekend for Black Widow. But it certainly comes close to it, and that's great. Now, does that mean that theaters are back? Theaters are back, baby! I don't know, maybe, but it also could just mean that Disney and Marvel know how to release a movie. This may be 100% attributable to how Disney promotes its stuff. Because let's face it, Marvel's had a track record of having some really great releases on odd times. You know, $150 million opening weekend for Captain Marvel in March. And more than $200 million on Valentine's Day weekend for Black Panther a couple years ago. This might just be a Disney thing because the only movies that have been really breakout hits over the last couple months have been Disney movies. You had Black Widow, you have this, Free Guy, which is 20th Century Fox, but that's part of Disney now. And those just may have been good releases and kind of timed at the right point. We also need to watch, see what happens to Shang-Chi's box office. See how much it drops this weekend, because Marvel movies are known for a significant drop second weekend. They tend to be front-loaded, and that's not uncommon for this marketplace. But if it's a drop of less than 60%, that's actually really good for Marvel. Now, if it tends to drop more than that, it's still not comparable to Black Widow, even if it ends up making more money in theaters, Black Widow, you got to add on that extra $125 million it made from Disney Plus. And I'd be curious as to what the internal numbers are for how much that really lost to piracy and how much that really is going to draw from its normal on-demand run, the sort of the down-the-line payment. I don't know if that's going to have as much of an impact as some people think. But this day and day stuff, this doesn't seem to be going anywhere, but it's very hard to analyze because it's not even just a not apples to apples thing. It's not even oranges to apples. This is a whole fruit salad. Disney Plus has the $30 premium on top of their monthly fee. Warner Brothers has HBO Mac with a $15 a month subscription, which is about twice of what Disney Plus is. Peacock's got a $5 a month plan for ads and $10 a month without ads, and that's similar to Paramount. General VOD, which is what the Universal titles have been going for and some of the Warner Brothers last year, that's anywhere from $6 to $30 per movie, per watch, and, you know, it's through a third-party service. Netflix and Amazon kind of have their own little hybrid model. There's a lot of stuff that have yet to be seen, and there's a lot of stuff that's going to happen, but I think this day-and-date stuff is not going anywhere. It's going to have some sort of life beyond the pandemic. If for no other reason, you've got an entire generation of people that aren't just okay with watching their stuff on their phones. That's their preferred method. And no amount of whining from Denis Villeneuve that you need to see his movies in the theater is going to stop Generation Z from watching stuff on a small format in the palm of their hand because they don't care. When it comes to movie going and that kind of content consumption, it's the younger generation that tends to drive it. So this 5 years from now, things are going to look very different. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The big trailer that hit this week was for The Matrix Resurrections, which is in theaters and HBO Max on December 22nd.
If you want the truth, Neo, you're going to have to fly me.
The only thing that matters to you is still here. I know it's why you're still fighting and why you will never give up.
You don't know me.
No?
After all these years, to be going back to where it all started. Back to the Matrix.
You know, this looks interesting. I think one of the big things is this is only directed by one of the Wachowskis. It's Lana Wachowski. Lily is doing her own thing. And it's not like they had a split. It's just that Lily was busy with other things. But Lana Wachowski's directing this. And it, what's neat about it is I like the fact, yeah, it's bringing in all these elements and you don't know there's mysteries and you're wondering what's happening in the story. But what's neat about this is it doesn't look like just another Matrix movie. And that's why I'm excited about it. It looks like there's going to be something a little bit different and a little bit more mystery. So I am definitely looking forward to The Matrix Resurrections. Now, the next one I wanted to cover made it a little bit difficult because I was trying to find a trailer that was appropriate for the radio. Well, here's the trailer for Moonfall, which is in theaters February 4th. Well, that was nonsensical. Oh, maybe we can find something that actually has a little more dialogue to it. I finally centered on to Belfast, which comes out into theaters on November 12th. This is Kenneth Branagh's new movie about a little boy growing up in Belfast in the 60s and 70s.
Mama says if we went across the water, they wouldn't understand the way we talk.
If they can't understand you, then they're not listening. You know who you are, don't you? You're Buddy from Belfast, where everybody knows you.
To cleanse the community a wee bit.
You wouldn't want to be the old man out in the street. Touch my family and I'll kill you.
Are we gonna have to leave Belfast?
This looks really sweet. I think it looks like a charming little movie. I love that concept of looking at something bigger in life and some major event in history from the child's perspective. I mean, you saw that to an extreme in like Jojo Rabbit, but even stuff like I watched Dairy Girls on Netflix and that really works in that sense too, where you have that look at Northern Ireland from just a teenager who's just trying to be a teenager, whereas the ages are different, circumstances are a little different. But it's really a unique perspective, and I'm looking forward to that one. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about language lessons and the lost Leonardo. Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about some smaller ones that are out this week. Let's start off with language lessons. A man is given a gift of online Spanish language lessons, and he forms a special bond with the teacher after tragedy strikes his life.
Hola!
I'm sorry, who are you? What are you doing in my house?
Who are you again? I'm your Spanish teacher.
So I have to speak Spanish for one day.
Well, I actually bought the 100 lesson package.
Will, did you buy me 100 Spanish lessons?
Yeah.
Why?
Because you wanted to learn Spanish, dummy.
Oh.
What I wanted to say, but I was kind of afraid to say, is...
This is directed by Natalie Morales, and it's also starring Mark Duplass, who's best known for stuff like The League, but also doing all these mumblecore comedies that he sort of helped innovate. You see him in a lot of stuff. He's also in The Morning Show, and he was on The Mindy Project. And this film takes place completely on a Zoom call. And we saw that with TV series like Staged with David Tennant and Michael Sheen. A thing that's going to be difficult in movies is framing a series or a film on a Zoom call, because after the last 2 years, the last thing people want to look at is a Zoom screen. And I get why people did it, because it was an efficient way of actually shooting stuff during the pandemic, because this was shot during the pandemic. And, you know, of course you have total control of the location, and it's usually very limited cast. I think there's only 3 people who actually appear in this movie, but there's one other character, plays Mark Duplass's husband, who shows up in the background. I don't even actually think you see him very, like, briefly once, but the whole story is that his husband had bought him these Spanish language lessons, even though he was somewhat fluent in Spanish, and he develops a special bond with his teacher, played by Natalie Morales, and she, like, lives in Costa Rica, and he's in California. And of course, she's very much working class, and he lives in a big house with a nice pool. They never really explain exactly everything he does, but it doesn't really matter. That's unimportant. It's just that he's, you know, he has plenty of money. It's you know, it's an interesting movie. It's weird because I'm used to seeing Mark Duplass in a whole bunch of different things, but he's also done other movies like Creep. If you've ever seen the horror movies Creep and Creep 2, which are close to found footage where they take place on a video camera, although they're better than your standard found footage movies. But he's done horror and thriller and weird stuff before, you know, very avant-garde, independent, you know, art house type stuff. So I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know much about this movie. And that's one thing I like. Every now and then I like to see a movie and know nothing about it. I did that with Malignant. We'll be talking about that later in the show. But going into a movie completely cold gives you an interesting experience, because I didn't know if it was this a comedy, a dramedy, a drama. Is it a horror film or what? And so I didn't know if there was anything sort of sinister going on. So it took me a while to figure out through the movie and, you know, this relationship between the two of them as friends and getting to know each other. But also everybody has their own private lives and their own secrets. It's effectively done. Now, Duplass, I think he helped to write it. They probably do a certain degree of improvisation through their lines, but Morales directs it. And I think she does a good job with it. I mean, in terms of, it's a movie like this is very difficult to do because you are limited in locations with the Zoom call, and it's hard to not make it a gimmick. Like, there was that movie Unfriended. It was a horror movie, but it was called Unfriended, and it was on a Skype call. And that does reek of being a gimmick, and at a certain point you have to transcend the gimmick to actually tell a story. And I believe she actually does so with this movie. Gets a little corny at parts, and it's a little bit cheesy. But overall, I mean, it's a sweet little story. I think it's all hinged on the two of them. They have weird on-screen chemistry they're on screen with each other and interacting, but they're never in the same room. But the fact that they have chemistry and they're not even in the same location, I think, is a testament to the movie and a testament to her directing abilities. And, you know, it's a smaller, intimate film. It's something you'd expect from Mark Duplass, where it's sort of this mumblecore territory. And a good chunk of it is in Spanish, because, of course, it's supposed to be an immersive language thing, and they speak to each other in Spanish, but it's subtitled. But, you know, it also has English in there as well, as you can tell by the trailer I played. So I'm going to have to say Language Lessons was a nice little surprising find for me. I enjoyed it. I thought it was sweet. I thought its heart's in the right place. And it had enough darkness in it to make it real, but it wasn't punishing. So I'm going to have to say that Language Lessons kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Lost Leonardo. This true story follows the discovery of what could be a painting by Leonardo da Vinci and the drama behind the scenes of restoring it, authenticating it, and eventually selling it.
There are only about 15 Leonardos known. To say I have found a picture like this is just so far-fetched. You're just going to look like a fool.
The joke was that that was a contemporary painting because 90% of it was painted during the restoration.
Something's fishy here.
But that's ridiculous.
If it was by the hand of the master, then it would be exponentially upon exponentially more valuable.
It was worth in excess of $200 million.
This is a documentary, and it's making its rounds through the country since about mid-August, and it's finally made its way to my hometown, Columbus, Ohio, so I thought I'd talk about it this week. And it's a documentary about this Leonardo painting, or is it a Leonardo painting? That's the whole thing. I mean, it certainly has a lot of weight of authenticity behind it, but even through the documentary, there are skeptics. There are people who don't think this is by Leonardo, that it was maybe done by one of his students or one of even his admirers, and it was so deteriorated over the years that in the restoration process, people who understood Leonardo painted over it and, you know, even say that in the trailer, that it's like mostly a new painting and only bits and pieces, and you can't even tell if those bits and pieces that were the original painting were from Leonardo. So that's still questioned, even though it certainly did get authenticated by certain people. Now, look, I don't know much about the art world. I'm not an art aficionado. But I understand how rare an actual painting by Leonardo da Vinci would be. And I get that. But one of the things that becomes a little frustrating for a movie like this, which is when you step outside of the art house, you know, this is very much an art house movie. This is a documentary people would see who appreciate art as a giant term that encompasses everything. Once you step outside of that art house, it gets very frustrating because here's a painting that somebody found in a collection and they bought for like $1,000, which to your average person, $1,000 for a painting is a lot. Your average person doesn't have $1,000 to just throw off to maybe pick up a decent painting. But, you know, eventually what they could sell it for, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, it's mind-boggling and it's frustrating because you got a lot of people who would watch this movie and they're like, I'm trying to make rent. And these people are tossing around millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars over a maybe. And so it does tend to reek of elitism. But you can admire it from afar, as I think of how I would do it. Like a painting in a museum, I can admire it from afar, but if you get too close to it and look too much in the details, it's infuriating and frustrating, which I guess is kind of the point. So I'm going to say, ultimately, The Lost Leonardo is interesting. I'm going to give it a kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Queen Pins and Small Engine Repair.
Fast, die young, bad girls, do it well. Live fast, die young, bad girls, do it well. Live fast, die young, bad girls, do it well.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Queen Pins. A suburban housewife searching for meaning in her life stumbles upon a scheme to make millions of dollars with a fraudulent coupon deal.
Lock and load! So what are we dealing with here? Gun runners? Drug dealers!
It's two women who are counterfeiting coupons.
This feels like a lot. You don't think we're coming in a little hot here, boss?
When you send these companies a complaint, they send you a coupon
for free stuff. All of these free coupons come from one factory.
It's like Robin Hood. We gotta steal these coupons and sell them to families who really need them. That's money in the bank.
When I first heard that this was about couponing, I didn't know if it was about the extreme couponing. If you don't remember what that was, about 10, 12 years ago, maybe 15, there was this push for extreme couponing where what you did is you got all these different coupons and you basically tracked how they scanned, and what people would do is they would engage in fraud where they would scan a coupon for Crest, but they'd go buy like the sample size one that was actually cost less than the coupon took off. And so there's all that stuff, and the retailers plugged a lot of those holes. So you can't do the extreme couponing the way they were. It was a big thing, but it actually amounted to fraud. That's what I thought this was about. It's not. I mean, they talk about it being a real case. I didn't read much up about what happened in the real case. The basic story behind this is Kristen Bell plays this housewife, and she's not having a great relationship with her husband, played by Joel McHale, and their marriage is falling apart. They had a bad pregnancy or whatever, or miscarriage. And so she's trying to get back on her feet and sort of find self-worth. And she's a big couponer, but the whole thing, she stumbles upon how to get free coupons. Like, a lot of times if you have a problem with a retailer, or not even a retailer, but a manufacturer, they'll send you, say, hey, oh, here's, you know, oh, you didn't like our box of Wheaties. Here's free box of Wheaties. You know, hopefully this one's better. And she found a way to do that, but that involves them going like to Mexico to the place where they print the coupons and being able to smuggle them out. And so you're dealing with international law, and the FBI could be involved because it's interstate commerce, and you're dealing with fraud and smuggling. I mean, there's a lot of issues that they open up. And I don't know how much of this is real, or how much of it is, you know, given a little bit of, you know, dramatic license. But there's another woman in town that she works with to do this. And they're really just two idiots doing that. And that's really where the fun part of this movie is. It just telling the story of it. Yeah, that's okay. I mean, it's an interesting story, but it could be about anybody. It's the fact that they're complete novices at this, and they don't know how to launder money, and they don't know how to set up a fraudulent bank account. They don't even know how to navigate PayPal and what triggers PayPal to like freeze their account because they have too much money going in and out. And that's where it's funny, because you're watching them just stumbling through this where a real criminal would know what they're doing. Then, of course, on the other hand, you got the people trying to take them down, and it's all run by Paul Walter Hauser, who everybody has seen him in, like, Richard Jewell. He was also in I, Tonya. Great actor, but he's very funny in this because he is super overzealous. I mean, he's sort of like a comedic version of Richard Jewell from the Richard Jewell movie, where he so wants to be a level of authority, and he really doesn't have it, and he's kind of a bumbling idiot. But he's very passionate about his stuff, and he ends up getting her noticed because there's a lot of complaints about this. And he ends up pairing up with a postal inspector played by Vince Vaughn, who is sort of almost a straight man in this situation, which is a little bit rare for, I mean, Vince Vaughn, he'll play the straight man. And that's what makes this movie enjoyable, is it's over the top and silly nature. And the fact that these criminals are idiot criminals, they don't know exactly what they're doing. And the guy who's, I mean, Vince Vaughn knows what he's doing because he's a postal inspector, but this loss prevention manager at this grocery chain, he is just so overly zealous, but so passionate about what he does. And the characters are all committed. The actors are what makes this work, because they're committed to those roles. Even Kristen Bell's character, who has the most growth and depth to her, really is kind of this bizarre caricature of a, we'd like to refer to as a happy-go-lucky Karen. I mean, she's not the Karen that makes your life a living hell as a retailer because she complains. She just is the one who always has a, you know, thick stack of coupons that's bigger than her stack of cash, you know. But I found this very funny. It was light and silly and stupid. This is not a heavy, hard-hitting movie, and it's not to be taken overly seriously. And, you know, it's not about the nuance of coupon delivery, but it tells that story of that person who has kind of a humdrum life, who wants something bigger and gets involved in something that excites them. But it's also very, very funny, because you got a lot of people who have a lot of experience with comedy, in particularly Kristen Bell and Vince Vaughn, but they take their roles seriously enough that it still plays as a real thing. And that's kind of what I found such a charm about this. I know it's not getting great reviews, but I liked it. I thought it was fun. So I'm going to have to say Queen Pins kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Small Engine Repair. Three friends from working class Manchester, New Hampshire, gather together for a night of fun, only to discover a darker meaning behind it.
I got steaks, I got booze, I got beer. We are hanging out tonight.
Meet my boys.
Hey, entertain our guests, please.
I got a story for you.
Look at that.
What are you talking about out there? Maybe you're joking about something.
What do I do here?
I've been working in this shop for over 10 years, trying to give my daughter a future.
Apparently, this was a play. John Barenthal's in it, and he was in the original play, I believe. Shea Whigham plays one of the characters in here. And I know sort of the point of this is an examination of modern masculinity and toxic masculinity and, repercussions of that and how it can be inherited and passed down. The problem with this movie is it lays stuff on so, so thick. It reminds me of a friend of mine when he saw the movie Whiplash. And Whiplash is a good movie, but this friend who I was talking to once about it, he happens to be gay. And there's so many homophobic slurs thrown around in Whiplash from the teacher, J.K. Simmons' characters. And yes, it's supposed to paint him as a bad person because he keeps throwing those around. And my friend was like, I couldn't watch the movie. I went through middle school and high school hearing that all the time. I don't need to spend an hour characterizing this guy with that. Get over it. Find a different way to show how terrible he is. Quit, throwing all this crap in my face that I heard that was hurtful to me. And I kind of feel the same way about this movie. You've got it populated with these guys, and they're all men, and they come from this working class area. And it is so overblown with that stupid, I'm not going to say toxic masculinity or modern masculinity, just stupid masculinity. They're making gay jokes about each other and punching each other and getting into fights and, drinking beer and being like the guys. I mean, that stuff's garbage. This insane, this locker room mentality that's the way it is in Men's Vegas. And like one of the guy's daughter, played by Sarah Bravo, you saw her in Cherry last year with Tom Holland. And look, she does an okay job in the role, but she lays it on like it's a thick, she's got this Manchester accent. She's like, hey, so what's going on, guys? We got to come down here. Come over here. I'm going to go apply for college. And I got in, she just like lays it on so thick. It's like she's playing a version of a grandmother at a certain point. It's not subtle at all. The other problem is the stuff that's interesting happened doesn't even happen until like an hour into the movie. Like the first hour of the film is just them punching each other in the balls and laughing at each other and making fun of each other and making sex jokes. And it's just like, oh my God, do you guys have any sort of depth? Do you have any sort of personality beyond beer swilling thugs? And you guys are the heroes in this story. I mean, finally, an hour in, something interesting happens and then it's okay for about 10 minutes. And then I see them going down another ridiculously homophobic path, almost like trying to solve things by just being bad about it. I know a lot of people love this movie. I know it's getting a lot of praise, but I thought it was a bore and a chore. And yeah, I did not like it. Yeah, so I'm going to have to say it sucks.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Kate, Malignant, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Vertigo. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the movie reviews and talk about Malignant. James Wan directs this horror film about a woman with a mysterious past who has visions of murders by a ghostly dark figure.
The body of Dr. Florence Weaver was found brutally murdered in her home this morning.
Did you know her?
No, but I saw her die.
I'm seeing things. I'm seeing murders as they're happening.
He says
his name is Gabriel.
I think he's someone from my past.
He's the devil.
This is one of those day and date releases. It's released by Warner Brothers, so it's in theaters right now. It is also on HBO Max right now, so you can watch it in one of two different ways. And, you know, I'm really torn on something like this because in some ways, seeing a movie like this, a horror movie, especially a James Wan horror movie, because James Wan understands light and shadow and darkness and how to frame stuff on the picture. So his stuff looks great on the big screen. And when you get that full Dolby mix, you can hear sounds all over the place. So, you know, unless you have a really, really good sound system at home, that's a real big advantage in the theater. I remember seeing Insidious in the theaters and just absolutely loving the depth of sound. And this movie, like everybody, lives in some weird haunted house. Or, I mean, it's this old style house, or there's some old style apartment or hotel or something like that. Oh, that's where all the murders are taking place. And this is perfect for that kind of a mix. But on the other hand, it's also something that would be great to watch at home. Turn down the lights, get the popcorn. You can completely control the environment. You know, when you're sitting there alone in your house watching it, it could be pretty scary that way as well. When it comes to James Wan, his earlier stuff I thought was okay. I liked Saw. I wasn't a huge fan of Dead Silence. But boy, when he hit that stride with Insidious and then The Conjuring, I fell in love with the guy's work. And oh, sure, it's neat to see that he did Fast and Furious 6, one of the Furious movies. And he also did Aquaman. So, I mean, the guy can do other stuff, but he is a great horror film director. And it's neat to see him coming back to this. Now, there's certain things in the marketing that you can see that evokes images from the 60s, like 60s giallo horror. There's, of course, that picture of the character on her side and her eye, and there's something pointed coming down at her eye. But it's also just an interesting story, it's not your typical ghost story. I wouldn't even know if I'd call it a ghost story. It's not your typical haunted house story. Again, I wouldn't know if I'd call it a haunted house story. There is something more to it than what you see when you start. Now, of course, I don't want to get into any spoilers, but the biggest problems I had at the beginning was a little bit murky of how they were settling into the story. It takes a while for yourself to kind of get comfortable within the story and to see what's going on. There's stuff happening and you really aren't sure how stuff fits together. So it's not as cohesive at the beginning, but as the movie goes on, it gets better and better. And finally, when they get to the end, or at least to the reveal, you might be able to guess some things or have an idea, but it's kind of bonkers. And, you know, I just recently watched the other day the movie The Manitou, which is this old movie from 1978 starring Tony Curtis. And it's this horror film that's completely over the top. And in a way, not necessarily the story elements are the same in this movie, although there are some weird connective tissue, if you pardon the pun. This movie reminds me of The Manitou because The Manitou starts out as just sort of this creepy movie and it just goes bonkers and over the top at the end. And this one really takes a bizarre turn and in a good way. I mean, it's not 100% perfect, but gosh, I enjoyed it. I thought it was kind of refreshing. It was different. It was not something we'd seen done before a billion times. And it also had James Wan's signature style of shooting and sound design. So yeah, I gotta say, I really did enjoy Malignant. I gotta say, I totally rocked.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Now's the time we're gonna talk about Kate. Kate is on Netflix. It is I have a friend in radio. She refers to a movie like this as a chick wick film or a chick wick flick. For so many years after John Wick came out and made a big splash at the box office, everybody's always trying to make the next John Wick movie. We saw that with something like Nobody earlier this year. But there's also this push to make a female John Wick. We saw that with Atomic Blonde. We saw that earlier this year with Gunpowder Milkshake. And this is another one of those chick wick movies. And it has a little bit of DOA thrown in there too, if you remember that movie from the 40s or the remake in the late 80s with Dennis Quaid. After being poisoned, an elite assassin in Japan uses her last day on Earth to hunt down the Yakuza who took her out.
I think I was poisoned before the hit. Who was the target?
The Grand Honcho of the Yakuza.
How much time do I have?
14 hours, maybe 15.
Kate, it's gonna be okay.
You won't get any more questions from me after today.
Who are you?
Kate.
One of the problems with any sort of John Wick style movie, whether it's a chick Wick or just a regular John Wick knockoff, is keeping a story and characters that are compelling because you are dealing with killers. This one puts it on the shoulders of Mary Elizabeth Winstead, and I think she shows that she has the chops in terms of the physicality and the stunts and that sort of thing to do a movie like this. To get her characterized, of course, in John Wick, it was the dog that helped and his yearning for his wife who had passed away. But in this one, you're really focusing on her relationship with one of the Yakuza's daughters or niece, and she has a unspoken connection there, and that sort of humanizes her. But it falls into some trite territory with the Japanese background in the Yakuza story. If you've seen enough Yakuza crime movies, you do see it spinning its wheels in the same grooves. It's also incredibly, incredibly predictable. I mean, I watched the first 5 minutes of the movie and I'm like, this is how it's going to end. And I was absolutely right. That's okay. You know, a movie like this is formulaic. It's going to be a little bit predictable. But ultimately, it's an action movie and it serves its purpose as an action movie. It's not as well done as a John Wick movie. It's not as over the top and crazy as something like Gunpowder Milkshake. But I still did enjoy it to a degree. It's kind of on the fence, but still, I'll give it a kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. It's actually an old movie, and it's a vintage film coming out on a new 4K release. So it was a good enough time as any to revisit the original Vertigo by Alfred Hitchcock. James Stewart stars as a cop on leave, suffering from acrophobia and vertigo, who is hired to follow a man's suicidal wife.
I don't want to die. There's someone inside me, and she says I must die. Scotty, don't let me go.
A beautiful girl, haunted by the desperate, unexplainable urge to destroy herself. A man possessed by the paralyzing vertigo that made him afraid of high places. What was the strange attraction that brought these two together in spite of the dark forces that tore them apart? The compulsion that drove her relentlessly to the point of no return.
I mean, as much as I love Psycho, and I would put Psycho as like one of my favorite films, but one of my favorite Hitchcock movies, for some strange reason, I'll always rank Rear Window higher because of the challenge of shooting it in one room and the set design and the suspense that they use and the character development and the chemistry between James Stewart and Grace Kelly. I think... Rear Window is a superior film. Vertigo always ends up showing up on these best films of all time lists. And I'm not exactly sure why. I mean, from an assembly standpoint, it's probably the most impeccably put together Hitchcock movie I've seen. The composition of the shots is really interesting. He does other things cinematically that are interesting, not just the special effects of the vertigo looking down and also the dream sequences. But for example, there's a scene where he's learning some backstory about something and it's dark. And as the story gets darker and darker, it starts getting darker and darker in the shop where they're at. And I think that's a neat little filmmaking element to it. The problem is it's the story is kind of flat. At least now it is. Maybe in 1958 when it came out, it wasn't. But Kim Novak is, I mean, she's beautiful, but there's not a whole lot of oomph behind her character. She is kind of this porcelain doll he chases around and gets obsessed with. And yes, the movie's about obsession and the movie's about men versus women. But ultimately, it's men trying to control women. And I don't think that rings very well right now. I bet 1958, it probably played very differently. It's still an interesting suspense movie. It certainly has all these elements of film noir, but it's not shot like a film noir movie. You know, so it's kind of bright and colorful in a lot of ways. So ultimately, it's really good, but you know, more than anything else, it made me want to go watch High Anxiety again with Mel Brooks. But still, I mean, I can't say it's a bad movie. It's enjoyable. It's worth checking out. So I'll give Vertigo a kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Also available this week on disc, we've got Justice League, the Snyder Cut. And there's also The Thing on 4K. The Rear Window is on 4K. And then finally on TV, you got Star Trek, the original series, the complete series, as well as Young Sheldon season 4, if you hate yourself. Anyways, that's it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Blue Bayou and the Eyes of Tammy Faye. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.